the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, November the 23rd. Your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting a partly cloudy day with winds from the southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Cedar Rapids will see a high of 42, 43 in Iowa City, falling to a low tonight of 31 in Cedar Rapids, 32 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 4:40 p.m., sunrise tomorrow morning at 7:07 a.m., for a total daylight period of 9 hours and 33 minutes. Now from the front page of today's Gazette, officials make final pleas for holiday caution. This is a national story from the Washington Post, but certainly is appropriate locally. With nationwide coronavirus hospitalizations topping 80,000 and case counts on the cusp of 200,000 a day, officials and experts are making final pleas for caution before Thanksgiving. As of Saturday, average cases reported each day in the United States had spiked more than 17% in a week, data tracked by the Washington Post show. Deaths are also on the rise, with some communities overwhelmed by the bodies. In El Paso County, Texas, the National Guard was called in to help the morgues. With the holiday travel rush underway, public health leaders cautioned this weekend that herd immunity from promising vaccines remains months away, and that every American's decisions this week will shape the country's virus trajectory. For those who plan to travel and be with others for the holiday, gatherings should be kept small, Tom Inglesby, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, said on Fox News Sunday. He recommended spending as much time outdoors as possible, keeping mealtimes short, wearing masks indoors, and removing masks only while eating. More than 1 million people went through Transportation Security Administration checkpoints in airports nationwide on Friday, according to data released daily by the agency, and more than 980,000 travelers were screened on Saturday. The number of travelers screened Friday was the second highest single-day rush since March 16. In an interview on CBS News Face the Nation, Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, said he understands that many Americans are experiencing COVID fatigue after months of pandemic restrictions now tightening again in many parts of the country. But traveling during the holidays and ignoring public health guidelines are going to get us into even more trouble than we're in right now, he said. Moncef Slaoui, chief scientific advisor to the White House's Operation Warp Speed vaccine effort, said on CNN's State of the Nation that about 70% of the American population will need to be vaccinated for true herd immunity to occur. That probably will happen around May, he said, based on health officials' current plans. Most people need to be immunized before we can go back to a normal life, he said. Some on the front lines of the country's pandemic response are not sure that months of messaging have gotten through to the public, however. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention advised Americans against Thanksgiving travel and get-togethers only days ago, after many people's plans already were set. Absolutely not, said Utah physician Sean Callahan, when asked whether the urgency of the country's situation had sunk in. He said soaring cases are already straining the quality of care at the University of Utah, where he works in one of the hospital's intensive care units and is an assistant professor of pulmonary and critical care. His own message for people is about more than Thanksgiving plans. Callahan said he's concerned that nurses and physicians already being asked to treat patients outside their usual areas of expertise. He thinks the problem will worsen. I'm worried that we are going to be asking a lot of providers to do things that are probably outside of their comfort zone, and care is going to suffer because we're being stretched and doing things we should not be doing, he said Sunday. The pressure on healthcare resources has spurred leaders nationwide into action. Utah Governor Gary Herbert, a Republican, said this month that he was mandating face coverings statewide in public settings and for people within 6 feet of anyone outside their household. The mandate does not apply to houses of worship. The reversal, following months of reluctance, came after hospitals warned that they may have to ration care. Now, holiday travel and gatherings threaten to make healthcare workers' tasks even harder. If you look at the map of spread across the country, you can see the risk. It's very visible. And moving through airports or travel hubs, I think that will increase people's risk, Inglesby of Johns Hopkins said. Even if they're driving from point to point, unfortunately, we don't know if we're infected when we walk into a gathering. He referred to recent data released by the CDC that said most infections are spread by people with no symptoms. The message for everyone is if you can't assume you don't have the virus, and you can't assume the people whose homes you are about to enter don't have the virus at this point in our pandemic, Inglesby said. The country's top health officials are telling people not to let their guards down and to continue heeding calls to socially distance, even as they are full of optimism about vaccine candidates. Traditionally and historically, highly efficacious and effective vaccines have crushed epidemics like smallpox and polio and measles, Fauci told NBC's Meet the Press. We can do that with the vaccines that are coming, that are going to be coming online. So we should make them be an incentive to have us double down even more with public health measures until we get the full component of the help that's on the way. Slawi, the Operation Warp Speed advisor, said Sunday that the federal government will be ready to start shipping vaccines within 24 hours after a candidate receives emergency authorization from the Food and Drug Administration. He noted that the CDC and its Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices must review the data and recommend what groups of people are immunized first. Also from today's front page, derecho construction crew to be paid after all. This is an article by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette staff. Workers from Texas who said they had not been paid for nearly a month of construction work in Cedar Rapids will be paid by a Colorado company overseeing the project. Blue Sky Restoration Contractors will pay more than $30,000 to at least six men who had been working with a subcontractor to repair ceiling leaks, hang drywall, install insulation, and paint and clean apartments at Cottage Grove Place since October 16. Company representatives last week said they were surprised the workers hadn't been paid. We were shocked, said Mike Erickson, Chief Operations Officer for Blue Sky. Our crews and subcontractors are a vital part of it. We immediately jumped in and started investigating. Erickson said Blue Sky's records showed they had paid the subcontractor, Pablo Ramirez of Houston, and didn't know whether or why workers had been paid what they were owed. Company representatives met with the workers Friday and reached a deal to pay wages and travel expenses, the Center for Worker Justice of Eastern Iowa reported. Blue Sky confirmed it planned to pay the workers. The Gazette reported last week that about 25 people marched to the Cottage Grove Place work site, where the workers walked off the job to join the protest. Groups that worked together toward the resolution include church leaders and union groups. Again, from the front page today, record voter turnout masks Iowa schism. An article by James Q. Lynch of the Gazette staff. It's a positive sign for democracy that nearly 1.7 million Iowans participated in the 2020 general election. But Paul Lasley worries the results highlight a growing dichotomy between rural and urban Iowa. So while we can celebrate record turnout, I'm quite troubled that the motivations were not about what's good for America or how we build a more perfect union, said Lastly, who has been teaching sociology at Iowa State University for 40 years. The 2020 election put an exclamation point on Iowa's rural-urban divide. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and President Donald Trump carried 91 and 93 largely rural counties, respectively, while their Democratic opponents, Theresa Greenfield and Joe Biden, carried the urban communities. Republicans also maintained their 32-18 Iowa Senate majority, and House Republicans increased their margin to 59-41. Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican of New Hartford, points out they now represent all or parts of 97 of 99 counties. Iowa's rural voters were not unique. In both 2016 and 2020, voters in the lion's share of the nation's rural counties backed Trump. Only 16 rural counties flipped from Trump in 2016 to Biden in 2020. Biden appears to be on track to win roughly the same share of rural counties as Hillary Clinton, about 10%, well below the 17% of rural counties President Barack Obama carried in 2012. According to an analysis by the Washington-based Economic Innovation Group, which advocates for policies to lessen geographic inequalities, Biden won rural counties with larger populations of minorities and people who migrated from other states. Rural Midwest counties Biden won had population growth that averaged 1.8% over the past 10 years, while counties Trump won saw an average population decline of 2.5%. Over the past 50 to 100 years, the Midwest has seen out-migration, economic stagnation, young people leaving, and towns withering, Lastly said. I think much of the rural-urban divide is the unequal, or at least perceptions of equal access and opportunities, he said. Lastly speculates that many rural voters are angry because they feel like they have been left behind. He blames both parties for the perception that other than the metro areas, Minneapolis, Des Moines, Kansas City, and Omaha, the rest of the Midwest doesn't count. So rural voters see a robust stock market and growth industries, said Lastly, who graduated in a class of 24 from a rural North Missouri high school. Their children and grandchildren have migrated out of the Midwest and have gone south and west to urban places and are enjoying lifestyles not possible in their local community. The split between rural and urban voters in Iowa may be a pent-up signal of distress. Iowa and the Midwest have experienced a series of shocks, starting with the farm debt crisis of the 1980s, natural disasters, and now a pandemic in which people are frustrated, if not angry, Lastly said. Passage of the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement really accelerated change in many rural communities, added Colin Lewis Beck, a visiting statistics professor and part of the University of Iowa's Public Policy Center's Iowa Small Towns Project. We've seen a hollowing out of small towns as industry has closed, he said, citing Maytag in Newton and Schaefer Penn Corporation in Fort Madison as examples of employers who abandoned facilities in Iowa. In addition, agriculture has become more concentrated. This has resulted in fewer job opportunities for people living in rural areas, he said. Lewis Beck points out that although Iowa's population has remained stable, cities like Des Moines, Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, and Ames have exploded in size as people migrate from rural to urban communities. That has led to a disconnect in Iowa politics and governing with rural issues no longer resonating with urban voters and vice versa. When voters go to the polls, I think they're really trying to find candidates that reflect their values, Lastly said. Contributing to that disconnect, said Jonathan Hladek, policy director for the Center for Rural Affairs in Lyons, Nebraska, is that rural values and voting patterns are shaped by an entrepreneurial mindset that permeates through rural communities. At their core, farms are small businesses, and if you live in town, most of the businesses on Main Street are going to be small businesses, said Hladek, who grew up on a family farm in Nebraska. If you don't own one of those, if you're not an entrepreneur, there's a pretty good chance you're working there. So it may be natural for those voters to value their independence. You want to run your business in the way that you think will be the most successful, without outside intervention, Hladek said. For better or worse, fair or not, the Republican Party is seen as the small government party, and that is going to give Republicans a leg up time and time again. That changes when the children of rural Iowa move to the big city, Hladek said. They are introduced to new ideas, cultures, experiences, opportunities, even new foods. As they move into the workforce, they are more likely to be part of a large corporation than a small business with an entrepreneurial feel. Living in Cedar Rapids or Des Moines or Davenport, they get a different perspective of an almost omnipresent government, Hladek said. You're seeing the government more often, and you're seeing them do different things, he said. You can't live in an urban area and feel like you can do all of this without some sort of government intervention. I think that really makes a big difference. It's not that government isn't present in rural communities, Hladek said. Many small businesses and farmers benefit from government programs. U.S. Department of Agriculture food stamp payments help support grocery stores. Hospitals and schools get federal support. Farmers, who Lewis Beck notes have historically voted for Republicans, also benefit from federal programs and payments. A generous farm bill that channeled money into rural areas and the Trump administration's trade relief payments to farmers have maintained rural Republican support. However, those transfers aren't out in the open, Hladek said, so you can quietly imagine yourself to be an avatar of independence while receiving that direct payment for your farm and not think twice about it, he said. No farmers think that those direct payments are handouts. Most of them are saying, hey, I'm working extremely hard. The markets are just not there for me right now, by no fault of my own. So this direct payment is completely justified. For all of their differences, the challenges faced by Iowans in cities and small towns may not be so different, said Iowa House Minority Leader Todd Pritchard, Democrat of Charles City, whose rural north-central Iowa district covers two counties that do not include Republican representation in the chamber. Communities in House 52 need funding for health care and education, as well as jobs that pay a living wage and a farm safety net, he said. Incoming Iowa Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls of Coralville thinks many of Iowans' concerns should bridge the rural-urban divide. He's one of three Democratic senators whose districts include substantial rural territory. Senate 37 includes suburban Johnson County, as well as rural Cedar and a bit of Muscatine counties. So it's a very geographically diverse area, and I see the same thing whether I'm in Coralville or I'm in Clarence, which is this growing gap between the haves and the have-nots, Walls said. What's been lost, according to Lasley and Hladek, is a statewide sense of common interest. There are several causes, but they both point to the rise of social media that has increasingly allowed communities of place and politics to replace communities of common interest. You can just choose your source to define the result you want, Hladek said. It challenges even the assumption that there could be a common interest. Lastly, who specializes in rural sociology, finds that as he travels Iowa, it is impossible not to be impressed by the buildings, the institutions, the organizations that people, generally volunteers, built. This was people working together across political divides and divisions across socioeconomic status, he said. That was our community and our neighbors helping each other. In light of the election results, Iowans need to return to what he calls neighboring. You know, even if we look different, act different, and vote differently, we still need to remain civil, he said. One way to do that is to listen and get to know our neighbors to stay connected. It's going to require that we listen rather than speak, that we reach out to those unlike ourselves. It's not that you necessarily have to agree, but the recognition that we have to work together, Lashley said, and I think the challenge will be is how do we get people to set aside differences for the common good? From the opinion page today, we have a guest column by Jen Newman. Ms. Newman is the CEO of DeNovo Marketing in Cedar Rapids. Her column is entitled, Reframe Mask Messages with Behavioral Science. I spend my professional time thinking about how decisions are made. If we're being transparent, I probably spend a fair amount of my personal time thinking about it as well. Behavioral science and design plays a big part in how businesses market to consumers and other businesses and create better, more effective campaigns. But I've been thinking a lot about how a particular behavioral design tactic, social proof, could change how we begin to gain wider adoption of important COVID-19 precautions in the midst of a pandemic that is tightening its grip on the Midwest. Information changes quickly. When I began writing this column, Governor Kim Reynolds had not yet enacted any mask requirements. Now that some requirements are in place, there still is the matter of getting the public to understand and adopt precautions. Whether it is wearing masks, or limiting or canceling gatherings outside of your household, or taking simple personal measures, such as avoiding touching your face and washing your hands frequently. When it comes to the subject of mask wearing in particular, media articles and social posts tend to focus on those not wearing masks, or politicians arguing for or against a mask mandate. This column is not about ordinances or requirements. This column addresses the fact that when we develop the narrative around the story of the few, we end up with the unintended effect of validation of the behavior we are seeking to change. We've all seen, and possibly even shared, posts about people not wearing masks. Many of these posts are sensational, sparking flame wars in the comments, and drive deeper wedges between two entrenched sides. Or perhaps we've seen or shared viral videos of a store clerk confronting a patron who refuses to wear a mask. You have to admit that that makes for very watchable content. No matter which side of the debate you come down on, you think, yeah, they told them. There is a principle in behavioral science called social proof. And right now, mask proponents are reinforcing the exact behavior that they are trying to change. Social proof is a psychological and social phenomenon wherein people copy the actions of others in an attempt to undertake behavior in a given situation. You might call it subliminal peer pressure. I don't have statistics on the percentage of locals who effectively wear masks in public. But anecdotally, when I go to a store, the majority of people I see are wearing them in compliance with the store's policies. Seeing other people in masks doesn't fire my brain up to take notice. But seeing one person above among 20, which is 5%, in a store without one or with it hanging under their nose does. We're wired to look for threats and for the things that stand outside the norm. But we are also wired to make decisions based on what we see modeled by the majority. Case in point, a front page story in the Gazette on November 16 focused on the nonchalant attitudes around mask wearing of some people in the Midwest. This was an Associated Press story and focused on quotes from people who feel that if they contract the virus, then they do. And they aren't overly concerned about it. I imagine some readers were upset by these attitudes, and there were others who thought, that's how I feel too. It was neutral reporting at best, without any statistics estimating how many people do or do not wear masks in a public setting in the Midwest or beyond. The article also focused on those gathering with others, despite the threat of the virus, but did not dig into the number of people who have adjusted or canceled their plans. It's not the media's job to push a narrative, but when we look at how we approach public health through a behavioral science lens, we see messages that are focused on restrictions and telling people what they cannot do. It's important to explicitly warn people of behaviors that are dangerous to the public. However, by focusing mostly on those who are not taking precautions, we give people the excuse not to mask up because they see the main narrative as most people do not want to or take part in wearing a mask in public. We can all identify with that. No one enjoys wearing a mask. But if we change the narrative to show the actual or close to it masking rate, we can change that perception. Example, 80% of people in Lynn and Johnson counties properly wear their mask in public. Now, suddenly, there is social proof and pressure that not wearing a mask is the minority viewpoint. My suggestion to our community leaders, to those who are active on social media, and to those who have and share influence, is to join others in flipping the script. Instead of admonishing the public for not wearing a mask, when the majority are, gather data that reinforces the behavior, thank and highlight those who exemplify it, and push that messaging far and wide, and back it up with language and campaigns. If we pull together in this endeavor, we will quickly change how people see this issue and themselves. More importantly, we will save lives. And that article by Jen Newman of the De Novo Marketing in Cedar Rapids. And we have, one, two, three letters to the editor today. The first one comes from Jerry Elsia of Cedar Rapids. His letter is entitled, They Gather Together to Ask the Don's Blessing. Politics in Donald Trump's America divides families. It has even split the Trumps themselves, reportedly over what post-election path to take. Presumably, the first family can iron things out at their annual November celebration. Thanks, grifting. That letter by Jerry Elsia of Cedar Rapids. The next letter comes from Scott Rowland, also of Cedar Rapids. Scott's letter is entitled, Voter Fraud is Rare. Even a Trump appointee admits it. If we want to have an honest conversation about the incidence of voter fraud, we should start with the probability. According to the Election Registration Information Center, out of 14.6 million votes cast by mail in the two previous general elections, there were about 372 instances of double votes or individuals voting on behalf of deceased people. This would represent 0.0025% of the total. In any given year, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has determined that your chance of being struck by lightning is 1 in 500,000. These are not the same odds, but the point is that they are comparable. However, if you are one of those people who doubt anything that emanates from an expert or commission that hasn't been blessed by President Donald Trump, you could look at the summary provided by one of the members who was appointed to the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, Matthew Dunlap. Indeed, based on the materials that were provided to him, it became abundantly clear that there have been only 938 cases since the year 2000. In the end, the commission was disbanded and did not issue a report. When this kind of outcome happens, it does not suggest an overwhelming amount of evidence is manifest. When elected officials treat election fraud as something that is rampant and constituting a serious threat to the integrity of elections, they are either lying or exhibiting an understanding that is comparable to a child. That letter by Scott Rowland of Cedar Rapids. Our final letter today comes from Mary McBee of Tama. Mary's letter is entitled, GOP has a double standard on mask mandates and abortion. What is democratic government if not a structure set up to serve the well-being of the people? Is it not meant to serve the common good and to protect the welfare and safety of the public? Governments are called upon to intrude upon lives for the sake of our general welfare in many ways, taxes for one, but especially for service during wars or pandemics. Conservative Republicans espouse individual freedom, demanding that no government has a right to enact a mandate for wearing masks in public or to avoid meetings and gatherings. Yet, these are obviously for the safety of the common good. However, in direct contrast, conservative Republicans do want the government to intrude upon private and personal lives far beyond the common good by deciding what a woman can do with her body or whom a person can marry. If that isn't hypocrisy, I don't know what is. And that letter by Mary McBee of Tama. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, November the 23rd, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First from Vinton, Ruth Ann Richardson, age 96, died peacefully at the Vinton Lutheran Home on Saturday, November the 21st. The Van Steen House Russell Funeral Home is caring for Ruth and her family. There will be a private burial at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton. From Cedar Rapids, Mark W. Biner passed away peacefully with his wife and daughter at his side at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids on Friday, November the 20th. Please join the family for a virtual funeral on Tuesday, November the 24th at 4 p.m. Central Time. From Marion, Ricky Allen Ties, Thies, T-H-I-E-S, age 60, of Marion, passed away on Saturday, November the 21st. A private family funeral service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. A live stream of the service can be viewed starting at 1 p.m. Wednesday, November 25, at client.tribucast.com. And from Cedar Rapids, Stephanie Ann Meese, age 66, died Saturday, November the 21st at Unity Point Health, St. Luke's, after a short battle with cancer. Private family services will be held with a burial at Spencer's Grove Cemetery. Friends may visit with the family at the TN Funeral Home on Tuesday from 3 to 7 p.m. Attendance is limited to more than 15 at a time, and all in attendance must wear a mask and comply with social distancing guidelines. From Marion, Betty Jean Karsner, age 91, passed away on Friday, November the 20th, at the Willow Gardens Care Center in Marion. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, November 27th, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Burial will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. From Iowa City, Kevin M., also known as Mitch Martin, age 64, a lifetime resident of this area, died on Friday, November 20, at Mercy Hospital after a long struggle with health issues. Public visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service. Private family services will be held at 1 p.m. Wednesday at the funeral home, with graveside services open to the public at 2 p.m. at Memory Gardens Cemetery. From Newhall, Dorothy Marie Selkin Ellis, age 96, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, November 18, at the West Ridge Care Center in Cedar Rapids. A private family mass of Christian burial will be held at St. Paul Catholic Church in Newhall. Interment will be at the Calvary Cemetery in Van Horn. From Marion, Anna Marie Klein, age 86, passed away on November 20 at the Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, there will be no visitation. A private service for immediate family and friends will be held with online attendance available at Our Savior's Lutheran Church. See our Facebook page on November 28 at 11 a.m. And from Cedar Rapids, Elroy B. Hill, age 98, passed away on Wednesday, November 18, at the Woodlands in the Methwick community. A private service will be held with burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery with military honors. From Cedar Rapids, Mick Burr left us at the age of 72 on Thursday, November 19, after suffering from aggressive metastatic lung cancer. He wished to be cremated and have no funeral service and was adamant about not having any military honors. And from Monticello, Marguerite Atkins Orcutt, age 95, passed away on Saturday, November 21st. Private family services will be held at the First Presbyterian Church in Monticello, where there will be a public visitation from 10 to 11 a.m. Wednesday, November 25. Interment will be in the Oakwood Cemetery. The Getch Funeral Home has taken care of Marguerite and her family. And from Lamont, Alice E. Conant, age 99, died Friday morning, November 20, at her home. A private family funeral service will be held at the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olewine. Interment in the Floral Hills Memorial Gardens in rural Olewine. Family and friends may view the funeral service on the funeral home website. And from Oxford, Patricia Ann Harney, age 82, passed away Saturday, November 21, at Lantern Park Specialty Care in Coralville. A massive Christian burial will be at 1 p.m. Wednesday, November 25th, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Oxford. Burial will follow at St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City. The family will greet friends an hour before Mass at the church. And from Wellsville, Kansas, Justin Birchman Steiff, age 19, passed away Monday, November 16. Memorial service will be at noon on Saturday, December 5, at Wilson's Funeral Home in Wellsville. Visitation is from 10 a.m. to noon before the services. And in other death notices from Blairstown, Cynthia A. Olin, age 79, died Saturday, November the 21st. The Phillips Funeral Home in Blairstown is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Michael John Lang, age 73, died Friday, November 20. The T.N. Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Jerry Morrow, age 63, died Saturday, November the 21st. The Brass Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Rosie Morrow, age 81, died Sunday, November 22. The Brass Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. Also from Cedar Rapids, Judy Stevens, age 77, died Monday, November the 16th. Her husband, Gary Stevens, 82, died Friday, November the 20th. The T.N. Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Earlville, Helene Sudmeyer, age 86, died Saturday, November 21st. The Clifton Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Earlville is assisting the family. And from Independence, Merlin G. Hermson, age 95, died Saturday, November 21. The Rife Family Center in Independence is assisting the family. And from Iowa City, Dr. Thomas H. Kent, age 86, died Saturday. The Lensing Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Iowa City is assisting the family. From Maynard, Arlene M. Prickett, age 92, died Saturday, November the 21st. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Maynard is assisting the family. And from Sigourney, Deborah Gillum, age 59, died Friday, November 20. The Holm Funeral Home in Sigourney is assisting the family. From Strawberry Point, Margaret Ann, also known as Peggy Duart, age 91, died Saturday, November the 21st. The Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Strawberry Point is assisting the family. And from Richland, Leilani, also known as Lonnie Watson, age 64, died Saturday. The Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Kyoto is assisting the family. And from Vinton, Thelma Esther Belknap, age 83, died Saturday, November the 21st. The Van Steenhuys Russell Funeral Home in Vinton is assisting the family. From Waukon, John, also known as Jack F. Marsden, age 95, died Saturday, November 21. The Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is assisting the family. And from West Liberty, Stanley Clark Hale, age 78, died Saturday, November the 21st. The Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Liberty is assisting the family. And finally, from Wilton, Randy Bell, age 83, died Saturday, November the 21st. The Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Liberty is assisting the family. And from today's sports page, we have an article about high school bowling. It's written by Justin Webster of the Gazette staff and entitled Bobcats Ready to Roll, They Hope. And from Van Horn, you don't have to be great to start, but you have to start to be great. Author and motivational speaker Zig Ziglar once uttered those words, and now Aaron Jens is living it as he tries to get the Benton Community Bowling Program off the ground amid a global pandemic. I've always been a bowler, said Jens, a teacher at Benton, who taught 5th and 6th grade for 28 years before retiring 2 years ago. I've always thought there were a lot of kids that aren't out for winter sports that don't have a lot to do, so I thought we should give it a shot. Not only is Jens arguably the most qualified person from the community for the job as a lifelong bowler, it goes much deeper than that. It means a lot to me just because I grew up in the area, Jens said. My whole life I've been a Benton Bobcat. Jens grew up in the Keystone area, where his father, Melvin Slim Jens, owned and operated the local lanes for 36 years. He was open 7 days a week, and I've had lots of people say they appreciated the time he spent with them helping kids, Jens said. He always had leagues going, and they were always full. After he passed away, the bowling fell off. After a fire destroyed the original Turner Hall lanes, a six-lane replacement eventually was built and named Slim Jens Lanes in honor of the Keystone community leader. Now, after a year as a club sport, Slim's son and the Bobcats are ready for their first season as a sanctioned team. Last year was kind of challenging because we couldn't compete against anybody because of sanctioning rules, Jens said. We were supposed to start in December, but we just went back to virtual as a school, and the rules are that if you are virtual, you can't participate. The good news for Jens and the Bobcats is most teams are in a similar situation, leaving the coach thankful for what he doesn't need to worry about. We've already missed 4 to 5 practices, but I don't have to worry about an offense or a defense, Jens said. I don't know how the basketball guys are doing it. Assuming competition resumes at some point, Jens is focused on learning over winning. He's scheduled schools with bigger home alleys, which allows for a full boys and girls varsity and junior varsity match since the 6 lanes in Keystone aren't large enough to host such an event. The Benton team consists of 8 girls, including 2 seniors, and 14 boys. That doesn't mean Benton won't build into a bigger team someday. Jens just wants to do it the right way. We need to start building a youth program, Jens said. I can't bring in freshmen every year and have that work. We need to start them younger. We just need to get people motivated to participate. And here's your Dear Abby for today. It's entitled, Twins Divided Over Mom's Treatment for Cancer. Dear Abby, my 63-year-old mother has been diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic lung cancer. Even prior to her diagnosis, she was a negative and depressed person. She's been a smoker and a drinker and backseat driver for almost 50 years. She has undergone intense radiation, but is refusing to take her chemo pill. In her words, why should she prolong her life by another year, especially if it causes more side effects and won't cure her? My twin and I are her only children. She has no significant life partner, and there are no grandkids. While I have kept in steady contact with her, my brother has taken an out-of-sight, out-of-mind attitude. We both live a 2 or 3 hour distance away from Mom. The problem now is that my brother wants her to persevere through all the doctor's treatments, while I have accepted her decision to essentially let go. How can I help him come to terms with Mom's decision? That's signed son/brother in California. And Abby responds, I firmly believe in a person's right to make their own decision when it comes to continuing or discontinuing treatment for a terminal illness. If your mother feels the chemotherapy has side effects that are too debilitating to tolerate, it should be her choice whether to discontinue them. If your mother prefers palliative or hospice care, she's entitled to have it, and she should discuss it with her doctor. And from the Iowa Today section, Iowa's still high virus spread bulges. This is a story by John McLaughlin of the Gazette staff. Iowa's skyrocketing spread of COVID-19 showed signs again Sunday of inching down from record levels, though measures remain high and public health officials continue to call for caution this holiday. The state reported that 3,403 new cases were added in the 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Sunday, bringing the state's total so far to 210,062. That new daily number helped continue to bring down the state's weekly average of new cases for the seventh day in a row, though that average remains far higher than it has been for the majority of the time the pandemic has been confirmed in Iowa. Linn County added 220 of the cases in the period, and its weekly average of new cases declined for the eighth day in a row. Johnson County added 92 cases, bringing its weekly average down for the seventh straight day. Still, the daily positivity rates in both counties remained at alarming levels, 51.51% in Linn and 25.92% in Johnson. Statewide, the daily positivity rate was 39.15%. The number of people being treated in Iowa hospitals for the disease inched down also in the 24-hour period. Current hospitalizations dropped from 1,416 to 1,340 patients. Those in intensive care declined from 273 to 255, and those placed on ventilators decreased from 137 to 132. In the 24-hour period, Iowa reported 33 COVID-19 deaths, 6 in Scott, 3 in each in Cerro Gordo and Polk, 2 each in Keokuk and Linn, and 1 each in Blackhawk, Cass, Des Moines, Dubuque, Harrison, Humboldt, Iowa, Page, Palo Alto, Pottawatomie, Shelby, Sioux, Tama, Warren, Washington, Winnesheek, and Woodbury counties. The additions bring Iowa's total COVID-19 deaths so far to 2,192. Public health officials are worried that Iowa's recent coronavirus spike will worsen and drive hospitalizations up if families hold gatherings or travel over the Thanksgiving holiday. High positivity rates and staff absences have driven students out of classrooms at several eastern Iowa school districts, as the systems have switched to temporary online-only instruction. Districts are hoping that the recent rampant spread of the disease will come under control so students can get back to in-person classes. We desperately want to have our kids re-enter our schools after Thanksgiving, Cedar Rapids Community School District Superintendent Noreen Bush wrote earlier this month to parents. For that to happen, we need to see the trend of positive COVID-19 cases decline, and the healthcare system needs to be stabilized and less taxed. Please take the safety measures when you are with others outside of your immediate household so we can stabilize our community and bring our kids back to school. And here's your Eastern Iowa briefs for today. First from Cedar Rapids, register for Cancer Center's Youth Holiday Celebration. Registration is due November 30 for the December 7th Children's Holiday Celebration planned by the Helen G. Nassif Community Cancer Center and Aiming for a Cure Foundation. The event is designed for families with children or grandchildren in their home undergoing cancer treatment or who are cancer survivors. It will be held from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. December 7 in the parking lot at the Cedar Rapids Country Club at 550 27th Street Drive Southeast. The new location allows for social distancing. Festivities include fireworks, holiday music, and an appearance by Santa. All families are asked to stay in or around their vehicles during the celebration. Attendees should wear masks if they step outside their vehicle and practice social distancing. Santa's elves will stay socially distanced while providing kid-friendly snacks and drinks, a holiday gift, and an art activity to take home. To register, go to bit.ly/NassifHoliday2020. Turkey Trot tradition goes virtual this year. A Cedar Rapids Thanksgiving tradition continues virtually in 2020 with the Thankful Turkey Half Marathon 10K and 5K commemorative gear. To participate, register to secure a spot and have the commemorative event gear mailed to your door. Then run or walk the distance between Thanksgiving Day and November 29 on a course of your choosing using your favorite tracking app or watch to help keep track of your time and distance. Afterward, submit your results to the leaderboard, print off your finisher certificate, and share with your friends using this year's Selfie Smile Medal. Cost is $30 for ages 12 and under, $60 for the 5K, 10K, and half marathon. For details and registration, go to iowaruns.com/Cedar Rapids Turkey Trot. And from Davenport, Putnam exhibit tells story of favorite toys. The Putnam Museum's new exhibit we'll examine the role of play and toys through culture and time in society. From antiquity and from around the world, guests will see toys that reflect societal norms and other sociological trends. Play, the story of toys, is an original Putnam exhibit and will remain open through 2021. Our latest exhibit features items from the Putnam's collection and will explore different themes surrounding gender, work roles, pop culture, fads, and advanced technology, to name a few, Putnam President and CEO Rachel Mullins said, adding that the display also features toys manufactured in the Quad Cities. We hope this exhibit brings about a sense of nostalgia for our guests. Visitors of all ages can view a variety of toys, including educational, creative, and those meant for the outdoors. The exhibit explores how gender roles in society were reinforced by children's toys. Visitors will be able to reminisce about favorite toy fads and dangerous toys they may have had growing up, as well as view new inclusive and technological toys. The exhibit is sponsored by a grant from the Scott County Regional Authority. Exhibit admission is included in the price of general admission, $9 for adults and $8 for ages 3 to 18, seniors, college students, and military. Admission is free for members. The museum is located at 1717 West 12th Street. Hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Wednesday to Sunday, and face masks are required. For more information, go to putnam.org/play-the-story-of-toys. For groups or to plan your visit, call 563-324-1933. Also from today's community page, Rocking Her World, a 5-year-old's idea to brighten sister's life goes global. Corrine, also known as Corey Sauls, has her very own rock garden underway at her new Iowa City home. These aren't just any rocks. They're hand-painted by rock enthusiasts around the United States, Europe, and New Zealand, with the promise of some from Africa once the cost of shipping goes back down. Not all are rocks. Some are minerals, fossils, and shells. They're pieces of a project Cora's family never imagined would come and go so far. Now 7, Cora has been beating the odds since her birth in September 2013 with the rare condition of trisomy 18. It gives her 3 number 18 chromosomes in each cell instead of 2, and it brings with it physical, mental, and developmental delays. In Cora's case, all of her vital symptoms are affected, said her mother, Joy Sauls, age 35, of Iowa City. Cora has issues with her digestive, cardio, and pulmonary systems, along with a very severe developmental and mental delays. Her mom likens her development level to that of a 1-year-old. Since Cora can no longer see the world around her, her sister Becca decided to bring the world first to their Cedar Rapids home and now to the Iowa City home, where they moved this month. Joy is an avid rock painter, enlisting the girls to help with that project, especially this year when so many other activities have been put on hold. And that does it for the reading of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette, Monday, November the 23rd. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thanks for listening.